Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Andy Finn Show. I'm Andy Finn, the Finn Man, and for the next hour, you're in Finland, here on WEBR Radio in Fairfax, Virginia. And, as usual, we start with the lighter stuff in life, and I gotta tell you, there's a fair amount of light stuff, and then there is foreign policy stuff. There's all kinds of stuff going on in the world. In general, America doesn't care much for foreign policy. For example, that's one of the big differences between, like, Fox News and CNN. Is CNN has always done a lot of foreign news and still does, and Fox News doesn't do much at all. I think they do Around the World in 80 Seconds. That's their coverage of foreign policy. But no, they cover more than that, but they don't cover a lot of it compared to somebody like CNN. And neither does MSNBC, for that matter. MSNBC is probably the more liberal network these days in some ways, but not as big on foreign affairs. But we're going to start with the lighter side of life and the U.S. Open Championship in golf was settled not yesterday as it's supposed to be every year, but today because it ended in a tie. And it was probably the most remarkable U.S. Open I've ever seen. And I've been watching them for a long time. So bear with me, even if you're not a sports fan, because this has a lot of drama and it has star power because Tiger Woods won his third U.S. Open today, his fourth major championship overall, and he did it in a way he's never done it before. My watching of the U.S. Open goes back to, I still remember being, I was probably 13 years old or something, because I remember what bedroom I had, and I didn't get that till I was a teenager. And Mom called me up for dinner, and I was sitting there on a Sunday afternoon watching Arnold Palmer win a golf tournament. I don't even know for sure that it was 1963, 62, 64, what. So I don't even know what tournament was. I want to say it was the U.S. Open, but I'm not even sure of the year, so I don't know. But I missed dinner to watch the end of the Open. And I can't explain it because no one in my family golfed. I didn't know anyone that played golf. I didn't particularly have anything invested in golf. I didn't own any golf clubs. I'd never been golfing. I'd never even hit a golf ball with a golf club. But that was the beginning of my interest in golf. Anyway, this weekend, the short version of what happened is this. Tiger Woods was injured and he still won. When he finished the Masters, 2 days later, he had arthroscopic surgery on his knee to remove cartilage, bone chips. And he has been recuperating ever since. That's only about 8 weeks. But he never passes up a major, so he came out to play the U.S. Open. That was his next planned stop on the tour. And every day his knee seemed to get worse. You put a lot of stress on your knees, on your whole body, when you swing a golf club. A lot of people think it's not, these guys aren't athletes, and that it's not much of a sport because they don't sweat much or work up much of a sweat. I recommend if you've never played golf that you go out and, if not try it, walk 18 holes with someone. Keep in mind, these guys don't ride carts in the pros like our weekend golfers do around the country. They walk the course. And if it's, think about this, it's a course that are usually 7,000 yards. Well, that's 3 times 7,000 feet. That's 21,000 feet. That's 4 miles right there. And that's assuming you're only walking tee to green. There's 40 yards between holes sometimes. There's uphills, downhills. And then they're spraying the ball from side to side in the fairway, as those of us who are not professionals do. So you probably walk 6 or 7 miles when you play a round of golf. It takes about 5 hours. In the heat of the day, you're out 5 hours, walking 6 miles, and swinging the club 100 times. If you're lucky, it's only 100. Not counting warm-up swings. And you're standing for the majority of that 5 hours. It's good exercise. So Tiger had to do all of this Now, he does have someone to carry his clubs. I forgot about that. You're carrying your clubs, too, or pulling them behind you on a cart when you walk. Tiger has a caddy, but his leg was hurting him by the third round. Saturday, his third round was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. He was behind by 5 strokes with 6 holes to play on Saturday, the third and second last round of the Open, and he ended up leading when the day was over. He eagled 2 holes. That means on a par 5, he got on the green in 2 and sunk a putt. He sunk 2 tough putts, one of them 65 feet long, and the roar from the galleries, you would think it was the final round. And then he chipped in on the 17th, meaning he hit a shot off the fringe with a pitching wedge, and it went right in the hole. That's 5 strokes under par on those 3 holes alone. Just an amazing display of golf, considering every time he swung the driver, he clutched his knee afterwards or fell and put his hand on the ground or winced in pain, because there's a lot of torque on your knees when you're swinging a golf club. So it was a pretty amazing display of golf, and as good as I've ever seen from anyone for a round of golf. So we come to the next day, and he's got the lead. Now, keep in mind, Tiger Woods is 13-0 in major championships when he has the lead or tied for the lead after 54 holes. That is 3 rounds into a 4-round tournament. Tiger ended up relinquishing that lead on Sunday. He was up by 1 stroke, and he made some bogeys, made some poor decisions in a couple of cases, which isn't like him. And Rocco Mediate takes the lead going into the 18th hole. Now, Rocco's a 45-year-old fella that's never won a major. No one has ever won a major, the U.S. Open, at this old in age. Someone's won it just a few months younger. And Rocco Mediate has never won one. He's well-liked, good sense of humor, relaxed on the course, although this is the U.S. Open. And it comes to the 18th hole, and Tiger Woods birdies the 18th to get into a tie. Now, the U.S. Open is the only major championship that requires an 18-hole playoff. Most of them play 4 holes after there's a tie, or maybe just 1 hole at a time, sudden death, to settle the championship. The U.S. Open, you come back the next day and play 18 holes. So NBC covered it today, and when I got home this afternoon, I caught the end of it. And once again, Rocco Mediate was up by a stroke. Tiger came along and he birdied the 18th hole to tie Rocco. Rocco couldn't squeeze out a birdie. He had a long putt and didn't make it. So now they're going to sudden death, 1 hole at a time. And on the very first hole, Tiger managed to win with a par when I think Rocco did bogey that hole. If I'm right, I'm trying to remember, actually. I don't think Tiger birdied it. But what an open. So this is more time than I usually spend on golf. But Tiger won, A, in a playoff. 2, he came from behind twice, which he almost never has to do. And 3, he won his 14th major. He is on pace to break Jack Nicklaus's record of 18 majors. And he's a couple years ahead of where Nicklaus was at this point. And Tiger wins several times a year, and he wins 1 or 2 majors a year. So he is very likely to continue making the argument with his career stats that he is the greatest golfer in history. But it was pretty amazing. A couple other things related to sports. One of them's related to golf. There was a fascinating article in the Washington Post yesterday about Japanese golf courses. Now, this is really an article about economics and about sociology as much as it's about golf. So bear with me. But an interesting thing has happened in Japan. It used to be that golf was so expensive in Japan that people would fly to Hawaii, play golf for a week or so, and fly back, and it was cheaper than playing the same number of rounds of golf in Japan. If you can believe this, the prices in Hawaii, including the prices of golf, And it's still cheaper to fly over from Japan to Hawaii to play golf. Because Japan's a small country. There's not a lot of land devoted to golf courses. And while they built a lot of golf courses in the 80s and particularly the 90s, they were reserved for private clubs. And instead of the, you know, $20,000, $30,000 you might pay to join a decent private club here, people were paying $100,000 or more to join a club. And they weren't having a lot of people play on the course. They were keeping the clubs pretty exclusive. And they took all day long to play around. You'd go for breakfast. And I didn't understand all this till I read this article in yesterday's Post. You would go for breakfast, tee off, play nine holes, come in for lunch, drink heavily, apparently, socialize. And everyone from the course did this, I guess, at some point. And then go back and play the other nine holes. It would be a 10 to 12-hour day on the at the course. It's pretty amazing. It takes 5 hours to play around here on the weekends, that is in the U.S., on public courses. But you're home at, you know, a total of 6 hours, and you're probably home. So it's twice as long to play a round of golf there. And golf costs between $300 and $400 to play around on a course if you don't have a membership. Well, most people can't afford that. And so what happened was when the economy went sour, people couldn't afford golf as much and afford these memberships, and the clubs couldn't stay in business, and so a lot of them were declaring bankruptcy. Well, it turns out that of all companies, Goldman Sachs stepped in and started buying up Japanese golf courses a few years ago. And along with one other foreign investment firm, they own 35% of all the golf courses in Japan. Well, that's a lot of golf courses. So they've revamped what they do and made them much more American style. They bought out people who had memberships, and people only got pennies on their dollars. But it's either that or hang around and play under the new rules. And the new rules are a lot more people are going on the course. You don't take all day to play. You do it like we do in the States. Speed it up a bit. Have a marshal on the course that tells people to speed it up. Don't require people to stop at lunch the way they did in Japan. Don't require people to hire caddies as they did in Japan. You can take carts. You can drive the carts onto the golf course, onto the fairways, which you couldn't used to do, even if in courses that allowed carts, and basically play it much more the way we play it in America. They've been able to bring the price down from about $300 a round to under $150 a round, and it's now semi-affordable. And this is another interesting thing I didn't understand. There's a whole generation of young golfers in Japan who only know golf from the driving range. There are driving ranges near a lot of the big cities, a lot of driving ranges, and people go there, young people go there for a date, pick up your girl and go to the driving range. Families go there. But people invest in a set of golf clubs, they go to the range, they get better as a golfer, but that's their only experience of golf. There are people who, quote, play golf or play at a range. They've got a decent swing, they own clubs, but they have never set foot on a golf course. They've never played a round of golf because it has been so expensive until recently in Japan. I just find that amazing. That explains it to me. Now I understand the stories I read 10, 20 years ago that said people in Japan would take their clubs, fly to Honolulu, play golf for a week, fly back, and it's cheaper than trying to play golf in Japan. That is amazing. It's no longer true. But when it was true, that's pretty amazing stuff. So we have Goldman Sachs to thank for making golf affordable in Japan. Who would have thunk it? One more article on sports, and this basically is a piece that the Post did yesterday on the cost of baseball tickets. And while they focused on the Washington Nationals, they did present the stats for every team in the major leagues. And basically, they talked about the cheap seats and the fact that there really aren't cheap seats anymore in baseball. Wrigley Field used to have, and I don't know if they still do, you could go and play. There were certain seats, I guess they were the bleacher seats, were $1. Those were the days, because the cheap seats now at Wrigley Field average. Now, these are, when I say cheap seats, I mean the general admission tickets. The average season ticket price in general seating is $42.50 at Wrigley Field for to see the Cubbies. That's the second highest in the country. The Red Sox are the highest at almost $49. Yankees and Mets are next. They're down at $41 for the Yankees, $34 for the Mets. And it goes down from there. The Washington Nationals are at $25, and they are right smack dab in the center of the 30 teams. The cheapest in the country are the Arizona Diamondbacks. They average $16 a seat for their average general admission ticket when you buy a season ticket package. But those are the general admission season tickets. There are the premium tickets, and they come with an amenity, usually, that is parking or waitress service or something. Now, you still pay for your drinks and you pay for the parking, but they come with the ability to buy premium parking or premium service. And these tickets, well, the average across the whole league is roughly $25 for the general admission season tickets. The average is three times that for the premium tickets. The league average, or I guess the major league average across all clubs for the premium seats is over $75. It's $76.26. That's the average price. The higher clubs are well over $100. There's six clubs that are over $100, including the Washington Nationals. Of course, it's a brand new stadium, and there's a lot of money in Washington. And so they can get away with it, I guess, is the thinking. For example, the Dodgers have the highest priced tickets, premium seats in the country. Of course, you've got a lot of wealthy people out in L.A. New York is second, the Yankees. And they're the only two clubs over $200 average for their premium season tickets seats per day. And the Nationals are at $125. It's just amazing to me, the price of tickets. Imagine taking a family of four to see Major League Baseball. It's a cliche now, but they've pushed it beyond what's affordable. And why? Because we're paying players so much more than we used to pay them. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm saying the owners did this to compete for better and better players. They jacked the price up to as much as the market will bear and then some. So it's an interesting phenomenon, but not one I'm going to spend any more time on. In fact, before we move on to our next item, before we move on to driving issues and road rage, we're going to take a short break.
You're listening to The Andy Finn Show, centrally located in America, on the TAFS radio network.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and we're listening to a little of REM on the break because they were here in town last Wednesday, and I went to see them. They were a great show, as they always are. My regular listeners know that I've been going to see REM since 1985, when I first saw them in New Jersey at Rutgers University, and they are an amazing concert. Really top-notch, high energy. Michael Stipe is an amazing rock star. And they, how do I want to put this? So they're an unusual band on a number of fronts. They really defy categorization at one level because they had a period of folk rock, then hard rock, and then experimentation with a couple different styles, and they do a range of things, but really entertaining band. And I should tell you about the ticket saga just briefly. I never buy tickets in advance, as you know if you listen to my show regularly. I always buy at the door, and I always sit close, and these days with the price of tickets, I almost never pay more than list price. So I was looking for good seats at a good price. I was willing to pay face value because it was only $75. I wanted to be 20, 25 rows out, dead center. I was with a friend, so we needed two tickets, and I couldn't find the seats I wanted. I almost pulled the trigger on front row seats, but the guy wanted $150. And it isn't that I don't mind paying that much to see a concert, and it was a bargain at one level. But I've seen REM from the first row. I've seen them from the fifth row. I've seen them from a lot of places. And I actually like the sound better 20 or 30 rows back, dead center, at any concert. It's not muffled, and you get the full sound, and you can see the stage just fine. Anyway, I settled for 30th row, a little bit to the right of left of center, paid $60 instead of $75, and of course no service charge, no $10 Ticketmaster service charge. And then D and I moved over and sat about 20th row, dead center, about a third of the way into the show because there were some empty seats. So a fine shoe was had by all. And let me move on to more important business, and that is really interesting piece in the Washington Post today about local traffic conditions. So if you're not local, I need to explain the Dulles Access Road. The Dulles Greenway, it's called, is a toll road that runs from Loudoun County through Fairfax County and in towards Washington, D.C., and people have to pay a toll on it. However, if you're going to the airport, you do not have to pay the toll. There are two express lanes on the inside of the Dulles Toll Road that you can get on. They only go to the airport, but they get you there for free. Well, it turns out that there's a loophole in the way this is constructed, and people can go into the airport from the west or a little bit east of them, and then get on the free part of the toll road. And in fact, if you're doing, quote, airport business, you not only can take the access road, the free part, and not pay the toll and not run into much traffic because there's not that much airport traffic compared to rush hour traffic morning and evening on the rest of the toll road, you are also allowed to take Route 66 downtown. And those of you who are local know that Route 66, Interstate 66, has the distinction of being one of the few roads of the country that is not just to have an HOV lane. It's HOV at rush hour in every lane. Going downtown in the morning, going out in the evening, you are not allowed on that road by yourself. You must take some other route, unless you're doing airport business. So the way they covered the article in the paper, they interviewed a few people who stop at the airport and buy a cup of coffee in the morning at the airport, and then they get on the toll road, and it's, if you're coming from the west and you've got a long drive, it can save you 45 minutes or more heading downtown. Well, that's well worth the price of a high-priced cup of coffee at the airport. So the people they're interviewing, they claim, are all buying a cup of coffee. Well, of course, the temptation would be to buy your cup of coffee elsewhere and just drive through the airport and then get on the toll road. How are they ever going to know whether or not you were at the airport that day? You could say you were dropping somebody off at the airport. Anyway, the police have a little sting operation they run occasionally, and they look for people who drive straight through. They notice them when they come in, and then they see if they drive right out, and then they radio ahead and nab them, and you have to pay a ticket then. So people may be stopping, people may not be, but I'm guessing that about 80% of the people that drive through the airport without stopping, without actually dropping somebody off or doing business at the airport, I bet they don't stop for the cup of coffee either. And I got one more bet to make for you, and that is that starting tomorrow, now that the article is in today's paper, that shortcut's going to get much more heavily used. It all comes down to, apparently, the definition of airport business. And what's interesting from the article, it said that the cops say, hey, look, it's up to a judge to decide airport business. They don't want to be arbitrating there. Okay, sir, were you at the airport or not? But they sort of have to. So they may give a ticket and leave it up to the judge. The judges say, hey, look, it's not up to me to determine this. The airport should decide what airport business is. So right now, buying a cup of coffee counts as airport business, apparently. But it'll be interesting to see if now, in view of this article and the heavier traffic that it will generate on the airport road, whether or not they will redefine airport business as you must be dropping someone off for a flight or picking someone up from a flight or going or coming to work at the airport, something like that. I wouldn't think that buying a cup of coffee at the airport qualifies as airport business, but right now it does. So we'll see what becomes of that. In any case, the other story that's traffic-related, before we get to the serious business, I'm just going to tell you what it's about, and we will continue it after the break. But I want you to think about the last time you ran into somebody with road rage, or let's just say aggressive drivers on the road. They don't have to show road rage, that is, get angry at you. But aggressive driving is, you know, weaving in and out of traffic, passing on the right consistently, going at a high rate of speed, those kinds of things. All the things you and I would never do, of course, but we hate it when other people do it. You know, George Carlin's definition of a jerk on the road, a jerk is the guy going faster than you, and an idiot is the guy in front of you who's going slower than you. He actually doesn't use those terms, but I can't say the terms he uses on the radio. In any case, we're going to take a break here on the Andy Finn Show on WEBR Radio. And when we come back, I'm going to tell you a very interesting fact about aggressive drivers and how you can spot them before they even get aggressive on you, at least a good correlation of aggressive driving and their vehicles. And then we'll move on to more weighty matters.